Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we will look into a number of stories and issues in the news. First, we'll go to Lebanon to speak with Los Angeles Times Middle East correspondent Borzu Deragahi, who has been reporting on the revolution next door in Syria, where there is a press blackout. With more demonstrations across Syria on Friday, in spite of murderous brutality from the Muhabarat, the secret police, and military intelligence officers, the unarmed Syrian people continue to challenge the callous and corrupt family clan who claim Syria for themselves. Then we will talk about the boom in overseas sales for U.S. arms manufacturers who, faced with proposed defense cuts at home, are gearing up to sell their wares abroad, in spite of recent examples in Tunisia, Egypt, and Bahrain, where some of this lethal hardware ends up being used against the defenseless people. Jeff Abramson, the Deputy Director of the Arms Control Association, joins us. Then finally, we'll examine the Obama administration's sellout to lobbyists representing the for-profit college and university racketeers who live off your federal dollars that they charge back to unsuspecting students who end up with a worthless education and under a mountain of debt from student loans that, nationwide, now surpass all credit card debt. David Halperin, Director of Campus Progress at the Center for American Progress, joins us. I'm now joined by Borzu Deragahi, who is the Middle East correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He has won the Overseas Press Club Award and has been twice nominated for the Pulitzer for his coverage of Iraq. His recent articles in the Los Angeles Times have covered the uprisings in Syria and its impact throughout the region. Welcome to Background Briefing, Borzu Deragahi. Are you there, Borzu?
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Yeah, I hear you.
So, one of the it's extraordinary, the courage of the Syrian people, given what they're facing, the unmitigated brutality of this regime. That every Friday, they throughout the country, they still take to the streets and get shot with heavy military hardware. In the north, we know people are being squeezed there and fleeing into Turkey. To get a sense of, I mean, in many ways, one would like to know what it is. We know what motivates the people who are risking their lives to free themselves. But what motivates the people who support this regime?
Well, it's complicated. I think, it is a minority regime. It is dominated by not only the country's Alawite, which is the sect that Bashar al-Assad and his immediate family belong to, but also other small Shiite sects. And it also has a buy-in from the country's various Christian denominations. And over the past 10 years or so, Bashar al-Assad has managed to woo certain elements of the majority Sunni business community. So I think to some extent what motivates the people who are supporting the regime is fear, terror, of what will come after Bashar al-Assad. Whether they will lose their status, whether they will lose their lives, whether they'll be subject to revenge attacks by people who've been the majority, who's been oppressed for so long. This is the dilemma of all minority regimes throughout history. This is the problem they have: is that it's very hard to go through a transition period that doesn't completely disenfranchise them, as was the case, for example, in South Africa, a very traumatic giving up of power by a minority group. And to some extent, that's it. And I think also, to a very, very lesser extent, it's an issue, the regime has been successful in convincing some people, as well as certain, Western analysts abroad, let's call them useful idiots, that if Assad goes, the Muslim Brotherhood will take over, and Syria will turn into a extremist Islamic state, which it will not.
Well, you could add to the the useful idiocy by suggesting that a lot of people believe the nonsense that Bashar al-Assad was a reformer, but there was a substantial demonstration the other day with a vast Syrian flag. And clearly there's a lot of patronage, I believe, in the support. But I take it that particularly the Christian minority, they must be looking next door at what happened in Iraq, where the Christians have all but been driven out. We've also, the Copts in Egypt have been met with a certain amount of brutality. They're a little insecure. So is that what's informing people about the possible consequences of the collapse of this regime?
Yeah, I mean, that is a fear. I would argue that, for example, Iraq is a sort of a strange exception in terms of the way the change came about, and the use of the Christians by the extremists as a sort of target. And Egypt, you do have sectarian issues there as well. But in many ways, having been to Syria and Egypt, they're very different countries. There's a much different feel to Syria and Egypt. And, by the way, Hosni Mubarak was not very good at protecting the Christians either in Egypt. Much of the sectarian strife that has happened in Egypt was under his rule.
Well, there were also suggestions that maybe he was covertly sparking those burnings and riots as a way to warn the people in that tactic that Gaddafi and all of them use, if I go, it's all Al-Qaeda. And I take it that's the Syrian regime's message as well. I was going to ask you, though, about what seems to be the key issue here in terms of, there's no question that the young people and that the psychological power of this regime has been broken. The more and more people don't fear them, and particularly the young. And I believe over half the country is under the age of 20. So it seems to me that you could make the calculus that maybe this is inevitable, that this regime will go. But what I think would be where it would crack surely would be within the military. And we're learning now more and more that the intelligence officers that are assigned to all the military units are the ones that are killing the soldiers. And if you're a Syrian soldier, you have an incredibly difficult choice between killing your people, your own defenseless fellow citizens, or being killed by Maher Assad's thugs. So do you think that the real crack will happen when the Sunni majority within the ranks break with the Alawite mafia?
Well, I think to some extent that might be happening on a small scale. I think that, for example, one of the reasons why, there's like a huge peaceful demonstration in one city, for example, Hama, on Friday. Meanwhile, just a few miles away in another city, they're crushing people and killing them. It's because basically the Syrian regime doesn't trust many huge swaths of its own military apparatus. And so it is relying on an increasingly thin sort of grouping of units, of 4th Armored Division being one of them, the Presidential Guard being another, to carry out its most sensitive operations. And it is not deploying, Syria has a huge military. It's not deploying the 500,000 soldiers it has on hand because from what we can see, it doesn't trust them.
Well, there's a report in Sunday's New York Times from the Turkish side of the border where there's refugee camps being set up, and there's a makeshift communications center. And one of the people that they quoted, of course, these people are concerned about being exposed back home and retribution to their families. But nevertheless, one of the people who was identified as a former cameraman with state television, and he was saying that he couldn't work with the propaganda machine anymore, and that everybody in the country, and particularly the journalists, know that the so-called police that are being murdered are in fact the army soldiers, mostly, who are being killed by Al-Assad's intelligence officers. So I guess it's pretty hard to get a sense of how far that's going along. I mean, there was a young officer on Al Jazeera recently who broke with the regime. But would you suggest that's the crack that we should be watching?
It's hard to tell what is happening within the security forces, especially at the higher echelons. But it's apparent that there are some major cracks that are developing. We saw that in Jisr Shagor, where the government itself was forced to admit that there were people in uniform shooting at other people in uniform. They tried to spin it as terrorists who somehow found security officials' uniforms and vehicles. But I think that one of the most poignant comments that I've heard in recent times was a Western diplomat who's in Syria. He's based in Syria, and he was saying to me, look, this is an ugly regime. Its downfall is very, very ugly, and its ultimate collapse is going to be very, very, very ugly. And I think that regional countries, Western countries as well, and other countries should be bracing for that ultimate collapse. And many people are already starting to see that this is a regime that can't last.
Again, I'm speaking with Borzu Dargahi, who is the Middle East correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He's in Beirut, Lebanon, where there were pro and con demonstrations, I take it, pro-regime, pro-Assad and pro-revolution there. And of course, we know that that the country of Lebanon was torn apart by a long civil war. And as I mentioned earlier, Iraq, the sectarian violence that followed the so-called liberation of Iraq by the Bush administration, surely is some kind of an object lesson in how hideous sectarian violence could be. But it seems, though, you reported about the apparent change of heart with the Turkish regime. Prime Minister Erdogan, I take it, feels quite passionate and personal about what's happening there, and he's let his feelings be known, and they've had a lot of trade and good relations with that country. Do you think that they will be a big influence in a post-Assad Syria?
I think that they will be. I think that, it's just very natural for Turkey, especially a Turkey that's, newly looking eastward instead of looking, at Europe as it had been for 80 years, to take a sort of large role in a country that is, has long been a part of its cultural and historic sphere of influence. As part of the Ottoman Empire, it is interesting. It's personal, but it's also political for Erdogan. The sectarian makeup of Syria, the sectarian and ethno-sectarian kind of structure of Syria, where you have Sunnis, various Shiite sects, Christians, and Kurds, is very similar to Turkey's ethno-sectarian makeup, and. People are starting to notice this in many ways, and so you have a situation where the Turkey's Alawites and Alevis are siding with the regime more than the country's Sunni majority, and the Kurds are starting to raise an eyebrow as well. So there's a strategic interest as well as a sort of sentimental attachment to what's happening there.
And Borzu Dargahi, we know that the Assad regime, to some extent, have manipulated the Palestinians. They have a substantial Palestinian population controlled by their Palestinian surrogates, if you will. But most of the analysis over here has been, well, this is just Assad trying to distract us from his problems at home. But it would seem to me that actually it's probably more than that, isn't he? He's really threatening the Israelis by saying I can, because the state television recently said there are 600,000 Palestinians who soon will be telling them to go home. Now, this apparently has resulted in some factional fighting within the Palestinian camps. And I believe Habash, the leader, almost got shot the other day. What do you know about that? Because the assumption would be if Assad can manipulate the Palestinians into these suicide attacks across the Golan Heights, then the Palestinians can't be too smart, which I fail to see that as being a real possibility.
Yeah, I mean, you got to think about the sort of insular and isolated Syrian leadership and the way they think about the world. They have various cards that they play, have the, Golan card that they can play. They can have the Palestinian card. They have the refugee card. There's a serious belief on the part of many people that they are creating this refugee crisis in Turkey, as well as a smaller one in Lebanon, and as well as some troubles on the Jordanian border, in order to send messages to the world that they can create a lot of trouble, that if the Syrian regime collapses, it's going to not go quietly into that good night. This issue with the Palestinians, although the Palestinians' cause is legitimate and there is a sort of Arab Spring sentiment in the Palestinian camps and in the occupied territories towards standing up for their rights in the face of the occupation, there is some concern that the Assad regime is sort of manipulating this issue, manipulating the Palestinian factions it controls to stir up trouble and send the world a message. In fact, there was a protest in one of the camps near Damascus where the mothers of some of those people who were killed trying to cross the Golan, cross into the Golan, Israeli-occupied Golan, were protesting against one of the pro-Syrian Palestinian factions who in turn opened fire and killed even more people, killed like 11 people who were conducting a protest against the pro-Syrian Palestinian PFLP general command.
And I had heard a report that actually Habash himself had to be taken, escorted out of there because people were so enraged.
Who are angry, yeah. They're saying, why are you, manipulating our sons into getting killed for your own cause? Now, there is a little bit of, intra-Palestinian rivalry at work there. Most likely the people who were stirring up this counter-protest were linked to Mahmoud Abbas's Fatah faction, protesting against some of the more pro-Syrian factions, such as Hamas and PFLP-GC. But still, there is this concern there. There is this worry there, even among the Palestinians themselves.
So just in closing, Bozid Aragahi, the British, the French, Portuguese and other Europeans are working on a draft resolution to condemn Syria through the Security Council. So far, any efforts in this regard have been blocked by Russia and China. Given the kind of geopolitical blackmail that you just described that the Assad regime's up to, they're saying to all the neighborhood, we can make life miserable for you. If we go down, we're going to go down and try and drag as many of you down with us. So what's the where's the likelihood of a break there? And it's frankly mystifying. What are the Chinese and the Russians thinking? Is it just that they're on the rejectionist front?
Well, I think, Syria's been a good customer of Russian weapons for many, many decades. So that's something to consider for the Russians to consider. And they worry that, a post Assad Syria, perhaps in the Western sphere of influence, will buy their weapons from, Turkey and the U.S. instead of from them. I'm sure that's one of the concerns. I think, though, if you parse the language of the Russian diplomats very carefully, they always say that, we will absolutely reject any resolution against Syria that includes the similar language that was in the resolution against Libya. So I think that there's a lot of wiggle room in there. No one wants to launch military action against Syria, anyway. And no one is asking for it, as was the case with Libya. You don't have a transitional Libyan government pleading for help. You don't have the Arab League endorsing it. So I think actually, I think China will do whatever Russia will do, and I'm fairly certain that Russia will either abstain or vote in favor of a watered-down resolution that excludes the possibility of military action.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today in Los Angeles from Beirut, Bozid Aragahi.
It's been a pleasure.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Bozid Aragahi, who is the Middle East correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about how the U.S. military-industrial complex is gearing up for record overseas sales of their arms.